This is a CBC podcast. Money. It shapes our world and motivates our actions. Greenback or Loonie, the Current's new season-long series, Project Money, follows the cash and explores what the mighty buck means to all of us. Go to cbc.ca/thecurrent for more.
Hello, I'm Michael Enright. Welcome to Rewind, where we bring you the sounds, the stories, and the music of yesterday. Today we celebrate the life and music of Jesse Winchester. He was one of Canada's most well-known draft dodgers, a man who both performed his own songs and wrote them for other musicians, a man described by so many as decent, sweet, kind, and gentlemanly. You may have heard that Jesse Winchester died in April, and at the time, perhaps you heard one of his songs or maybe his lovely southern accent. Well, today on Rewind, we wanted to bring you more songs and more stories from this singer-songwriter who had deep roots in the southern United States, but embraced Montreal as home. We're going to hear plenty from Jesse in this hour, but we start with a piece from the CBC radio program Identities that sets the scene for Jesse Winchester's arrival in Canada. Between 1966 and 1973, 30,000 draft dodgers came to Canada to seek refuge.
Protests exploded on university campuses across North America when the U.S. went to war in Vietnam. Many young Americans wanted no part of it, like Larry Kearley.
At the time, I was in the U.S. Army, and I had been fighting against the war from before the time I went into the Army. During the time I was in the Army, and it became clear I was getting nowhere, and I was being sent to Vietnam to be a spy, basically. And I'd asked for a discharge on conscientious objector grounds, and I was refused. And I was basically told that I'd wake up one morning in Vietnam if I didn't cooperate, so I left.
Like many war resistors, he came to Canada. Immigration was easy, and it wasn't far away from Mom and Dad. Jesse Winchester of Memphis, then a budding musician, traded a draft card for a one-way flight to Montreal.
I knew nothing about Canada. I had to go look it up in the encyclopedia under C. And I started at ground zero in my becoming a Canadian.
This doesn't surprise Nancy Pocock of Toronto, who is both friend and mother to draft dodgers.
They used to sit in our living room and say, "We want a homestead." They thought they were going out in the wilderness and build a log cabin or something like that. Many of them were quite ignorant, or they expected it to be snow into the summer and so on. They really learned nothing about Canada.
Talking about Canada helped distract them from the fact they could never go home.
It was pretty hard for them. They were young. Many of them had never been away from home before. Or if they'd been to university, that was the all. And it was a wrench for them. Americans are very patriotic, and it was very difficult.
As Robert Fulford wrote at the time, these scared young men were sentenced to a unique limbo. Like most Canadians, they could get American culture with a switch of the TV. But unlike most Canadians, they couldn't fly off to Florida. But gradually, these new immigrants began adapting to this promised land. Dennis Bartels fled California to settle in Edmonton.
I can remember when I first came up to Canada, after about, two or three months, I realized all the subscriptions I had to periodicals and newspapers and so on were from the U.S., and I thought, this is no good. I'm not there anymore. I have to find out what's happening here and become a Canadian. So I dropped all those subscriptions. I started subscribing to Canadian periodicals and so on, and, that's the way it's been ever since.
The singing draft dodger, Jesse Winchester, feels right at home whether it's Detroit or Edmonton. The country isn't important.
Nationalism for me is a very low emotion, which should, I don't believe, ever get any more serious than cheering for the home team in a hockey game. You know, but beyond that, because it emphasizes the differences between people. And Lord knows they don't need any emphasizing. You know, we need to emphasize the similarities between us rather than the differences. And nationalism, to me, is for kids.
But Jesse Winchester says Montreal is home, And like most Montrealers, this Tennessee-born singer speaks French.
I learned it here. I had it in school, but, you know, you don't learn much in school.
And you use your French?
Yeah, I use it. I, unfortunately, at home, I speak mainly English, and my wife is responsible for teaching the children French, and I'm very lazy about it. But I listen to French radio and TV as sort of free lessons, and I speak it when I go out to stores and things like that.
Is that something that you would associate with your Canadian identity, the fact that you as an ex-American speaks French in Canada?
I'm very proud of it, I must admit. And yeah, it makes me feel more Canadian and somehow different, you know, from the Americans. And I suppose there's a harmless bit of pride in there somewhere.
He says this country has given him everything, a wife, children, and a career.
Jesse Winchester in 1985 on the CBC radio program Identities. Winchester not only spoke French, he even wrote French songs. Winchester lived happily in his new country, but his roots in Memphis were deep and its influence on him unmistakable. Let's go back and hear a little more about how it was that he ended up in Canada as a 22-year-old. This is from the CBC radio program Touch the Earth in 1975.
I come from an old Memphis family and a long, proud heritage. My great-great-great-great-great-grandfather founded Memphis along with Andrew Jackson and James Overton. We've been there ever since as a political, moral force, if not intellectual and artistic, I don't know.
Any other musical people in your family?
No. No, I'm the
just
first
you.
Deviation.
Why do you say deviation?
Well, we're all lawyers, generally.
Politicians?
Equivocators. Politicians, yeah. I was a musician always, really, since I was a small child. I enjoyed music and played music and began studying in kindergarten. There was never anything that I wanted to do more. I always wanted to be a musician. My heroes were all musicians.
Like who?
Back in those days, it was Hank Williams to start with, and Ivory Joe Hunter, and then Elvis Presley came along, and Carl Perkins, and Jerry Lee Lewis was a real big hero for me. I flattered myself that I was going to become a jazz musician, but that never materialized. It was more or less because jazz was cool and country music or rock and roll was not. And country music was supposed to be a little bit proletarian. So I practiced hard every day to get my Johnny Smith licks together. And I just never could, really. It never touched me, jazz. Never touched my heart, you know. Whereas Jerry Lee Lewis could make me sit down and cry, you know, with a country ballad. Jazz impressed me with its technical facility, but never really moved my heart.
Moving on to when you decided to come to Canada, seems you had a contretemps with the draft, like many American people at that time.
Uh-huh.
That would be 1967?
That's right.
What age were you then?
I was about 22. Oh yeah, I was cannon fodder.
So what happened there?
I got out of college. The only reason I'd been in college was to stay out of the Army. And I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do because my degree meant nothing to me. And I was playing cocktail piano in a bar in Memphis. My draft notice came in December of 66. And that was kind of the last straw. I didn't like Memphis very much. I'd been to the North to school, and after that, after the North, after Massachusetts, Tennessee seemed sort of provincial. I don't feel the same way anymore, but at the time I thought that Tennessee was the boondocks, and the draft notice came. The thought of starting a new life in Canada, which from a distance seemed to be a very cultivated, civilized country, and up close it seems to be the same thing, may I add. So I decided that I would move to Canada and
just to forget about the whole mess. So I did. I got a plane ticket, kind of furtively, because I was scared that they were watching the Air Canada ticket offices or something. I don't know.
How did your family feel about that?
The only person who knew my plans was my mother. She had the same feelings about Canada that I did, that it was a little bit more civilized place to live than Memphis, Tennessee was. So, although she hated to see me go, she did see me go. My grandfather, who was sort of the patriarch of our family, I mean the gray-headed patriarch, you know, like they used to have, he was tremendously hurt and disappointed in me, and that was really painful for me, to say nothing of what it was for him. I didn't want to hurt my grandfather because I respected his opinions, and I still do. My grandfather wrote me many a letter after I got up here saying to the effect that my country, may she always be right, but right or wrong, my country. But I'd made my decision. If I had wanted to stay in the United States and remain an American, I would have stayed, and I would have suffered the consequences, fought, whatever. I left. I chose to leave. I have to take a positive attitude and be a Canadian, and that's the way I look at it. I am a Canadian, and I intend to be the best Canadian I know how. I have no intention of looking backwards.
Why did you choose Montreal above all the other Canadian cities?
It was French, for one thing. I wanted sort of the half-French, half-English demi-monde that would be a real change from Memphis, Tennessee. I thought Toronto might just be another Detroit or Cleveland or something like that, which didn't interest me at all. As a Southerner, I have a genuine prejudice against Northern American cities. I just don't like Yankees, you know. And I thought that a French town where I could still live as a North American but be in a sort of a milieu that would not be Yankee like Toronto is. I was right. I was absolutely right. Thank God for once in my life.
So let's take you back to that time. What month was it in 67?
January.
January, the midst of winter, the midst of a Montreal winter.
Oh, Lord, was it ever, yes.
So you came from Memphis, Tennessee, where it's nice and warm, to this cold Canadian city. Your plane touched down, and what were your impressions?
And I drove in on the shuttle bus from the airport, and there were two people sitting behind me, and they were speaking French and English mixed in together. And it was very impressive that people would be doing this in North America, actually shifting back and forth between French and English. And then came riding into Montreal on the 2 and 20 and seeing the signs in French and realizing that, it really is a French city, you know. And that night I checked in the Laurentian Hotel, and the next morning I walked out, and it was, I don't know how cold it was. I think it was about minus 30. It was one of the coldest days of the year, it turned out, but I didn't know that. I thought this was, you know, par for the course. And the hairs in my nostrils started to freeze, you know, when I inhaled. And I had never felt that before. And I didn't know what was wrong with my nose, you know. So I said, my Lord, what is this? And then I started to realize after I'd walked for a couple of blocks that it was just that cold.
Jesse Winchester in 1975 talking about his first days in Canada. Today on Rewind, it's an hour of Jesse Winchester, the American-born singer and songwriter who made his home in Canada to avoid the Vietnam War draft. We return now to an interview from 1975 where he described his early days in Montreal.
Finally, I said, well, I'm going to have some money here because my funds are running out. So I got a job with a little rock and roll band called Les Astronauts, a French rock and roll band. We played bars and hotel lounges, things like that. And we were playing in towns like Alma and Chicoutimi, Lac Saint-Jean, and Sept-Îles and places like that where nobody speaks English. And I started getting way down. And this was in the dead of winter, of course. And I liked it when we got back to Montreal, but to play in a small town like Alma where there are no bookstores and there are no restaurants. I was watching the first hockey games of my life, you know, broadcast in a language that I didn't really understand. I was just completely like a fish out of water. Then the guy wanted us to dress up in leotards with silver lame bikini pants and little helmets and stuff to look like his conception of what astronauts look like. So I said, well, no, you know.
Oh, ma belle, Marie-Thérèse, t'as assez assise, laisse ta chaise et bon temps roulé. Bon temps roulé. Laisse les bon temps roulé. Tout le monde est dans la cuisine. Y a du vin fait par ma voisine. Bon temps roulé. Bon temps roulé.
I had so many bad experiences with bands, and we lost so many jobs that I got really fed up with it and became sort of a hippie. And
what do you mean by hippie?
Well, I started thinking it was a sin to sell your music, and right way to live was be kind of like a Franciscan or something. And what it amounted to was living off of other people. Finally, the person who was supporting me, this girl, you know, she said, well, you're a good musician and you shouldn't be doing this, you know, you belong in the music business. So she had a friend who owned a club and got me a job playing by myself. I wasn't willing to go back and hassle around with any more bands at that time anyway. To sort of spice up the act, I started writing songs. That was the beginning of my solo career, I suppose.
Jesse Winchester finding his feet in his new home of Montreal soon after he had fled the U.S., in 1970, he got a big break when he met Robbie Robertson of The Band, who were getting attention for their album Music from Big Pink. Robertson ended up producing Winchester's debut album. Winchester released several albums during the 1970s, but because he was a draft resister, he was unable to tour in the United States. He turned to songwriting and became known as a top-notch writer. Songs such as Payday, Biloxi, and Rumba Man were recorded by everyone from the Everly Brothers to Jimmy Buffett, Emmylou Harris to Lucinda Williams. When Jimmy Carter was elected president in 1977, he granted amnesty to all draft evaders unless they had deserted or become citizens of another country. Jesse Winchester had taken out Canadian citizenship in 1972, but his manager convinced Carter to expand the amnesty. He was able to go home to Memphis for the first time in 10 years. When Winchester performed in concert in the U.S. for the first time, the reaction was rapturous. The magazine Rolling Stone covered the event and said that his was the greatest voice of the decade. Our next clip is from 1978 and the CBC radio program, The Entertainers.
For so long, people would always say, oh, Jesse Winchester, he lives in Montreal because he avoided the draft. And virtually every interview I ever read about you, that question always came up. And I was wondering if that's finally died down.
Well, apparently not, Michael. for the most part, yes. When I went back into the States, for the first time, it was a big story for the journalists. But now, when I go back, it's no big deal anymore. The onus is on me to play well and to write well and perform well. So I hope by doing that, I can take the focus off my politics and put them on the music.
Are you making up for lost time now and playing more in the United States, or do you have aspirations of playing? I know you went to Australia once and England. Do you want to do that again?
Yeah, I'd love to go back to both those places. The United States is the big enchilada, as John Ehrlichman said, and that's really the important nut to crack, even for people from Australia and England and Canada. So until I do that, going back to England and Australia would really be just sort of a flailing the dead cheval, you know.
What places in the States have been the most responsive to you so far?
Memphis, and I seem to do best in large cities and in places where there are universities. California, I do well in Texas.
An interview from 1978. Winchester may have been touring in the U.S., but his home was still Canada. I talked to him in 1999.
You could have gone back to the States after Jimmy Carter gave the amnesty. You could have.
I came here believing that the contract read, you can avoid this war if you never come back. So I said, okay, deal. And so I came here with that in mind, that I was going to make my life here. And
you're going to hold up your end of the bargain.
I was going to live up to my end of the bargain. And I never dreamt that they would let us come back. So when they did, I just wasn't really ready for it. I had a Canadian wife and Canadian children and a Canadian mortgage. I think it's very generous of the American people to let us come back to the States. It's a sign of bigness of spirit, I think.
You write about loss. There's an elegiac quality to what you write about, what you talk about, and yet there's a certain kind of, I guess, a romanticism mixed in there somehow. Are you a romantic? Were you ever? Are you still? Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the romantic faction?
Well, there have been complaints. Yes, I am. I grew up loving to hear the boys singing to the girls, and I still feel that way. There's just something so sweet about it and so human. It never fails to touch me. So, yeah, I guess that makes me a romantic.
The reason I ask is because I'm told by our excellent producers that you have a well-worn copy in your studio of The Devil's Dictionary by Ambrose Bierce. Is that true?
Yes, it is. I like biting humor. I like humor with an edge to it, which Bierce definitely had. Although I have to say I'm also a big fan of P.G. Woodhouse. The only thing I belong to besides ASCAP is the Woodhouse Society.
Really? Woodhouse and Bierce. Wow.
Yeah, they don't seem to go together, do they? But I love them both.
You know Bierce disappeared in Mexico, went off into the wilderness. You're not going to disappear, are you, into the townships or Quebec or someplace?
I don't have any plans to do that, although people have accused me of doing just that.
That was from 1999. Winchester moved to Virginia with his second wife, Cindy, in 2002. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to Rewind, where we bring you treasures from the CBC Radio Archives. Today it's the songs and stories of Jesse Winchester. He was not only a great singer and songwriter, he had a deep and abiding love of words. As he told one interviewer, he couldn't even sit down to eat a meal without reading. This clip is from the program The Entertainers in 1978.
You're not a fan, per se, of other people's music, but you find you're more of a literary fan. Does some of the inspiration from your songs come from reading?
Yes, it definitely does. I find, at the risk of sounding pious, I find the Bible very good inspiration for me. Of course, a lot of other books, history and things like that, I'm interested in, and the ideas and the language I find in those books is very inspiring. By inspiring, I mean, I suppose, I mean, I steal from them liberally.
For a performer who was as shy as Jesse Winchester, it could be tough to perform in public. Here he is with Ralph Ben-Murghi in 1989.
I'm sort of ambivalent about making a display of myself, I suppose. In a certain sense, I'm ambitious, and in another sense, I think there's something shameful about wanting to draw attention to yourself. So that's always been a big problem with me, I think, and that has a lot to do with my sort of, who was it, Achilles, the guy who went and sat in his tent until somebody came to fetch him out, you know. It embarrasses me to see people going around saying, love me, make me a star. And when I see myself doing it, it's obviously it's much worse. So, because I'm so inept at it, I suppose. If I did it better, it wouldn't bother
me. Oh, come on, I find you kind of endearing because you're not giving me any attitude. You're just up there doing your song.
Well, thank you. Maybe that's the ultimate attitude, but I have sort of a writer's kind of a personality, I think, which is to say very little.
You just let the pen do the talking at that point.
Well, that's the idea anyway.
Has writing getting any easier or harder as you get older?
It gets better. I'm a much stricter editor with myself these days, and I'm a lot happier with the results. I know that I want to write mainstream country pop music, and I think I'm actually getting good at it. Now, I realize this may be just a gross conceit that I'm nursing somewhere, but that's, you know, what else do I have to offer you but gross conceits? Yeah.
That's right, and a bit of a puffy chest and all
that's
that.
That's it, sure. Here's one now. If only this were TV.
That's right. Look at the size of that man's chest.
Yes.
You talk about country and you talk about pop. I mean, weren't you a kid who sort of really wanted to be an R&B star and all of that?
Yeah, I did when I was younger. I imitated the black artists and loved them. And for a long time, I listened only to black artists. It was sort of a point of pride with me. But I hope what it means is I grew up and I realized that my roots were country. And I'm proud of everything I learned from the black artists, and I never, ever want to forget it or what I owe to them. But I'm white. Let's face it.
That's right. There's no way around it. Even if you're from Tennessee, you're still white.
I'm still white.
Boy, the realizations that come in life, eh?
Isn't it something, you know? Well, look, I don't know if Mick Jagger, if the news has ever got hold of Mick Jagger, or if it ever will.
That's right.
Music has taken me to a lot of places. It's been so much more than just music, just sound to me. I mean, it's been a business life. I've learned, you know, or I've started to learn the ways of the business world because of music, because I kept after music, and I signed a recording contract, and it took me into that part of life. It's got me traveling, it's got me meeting people I never would have met, it's got me like, if I get a bad review, it's sent me way down. If I get a good review, it's sent me way up. I mean, it's just batted my emotions around like a tennis ball. And that's how you learn in life, I guess, is just getting put through the ringer like that. And if I hadn't had something to follow, like music, I would never have, I think I would have been tempted to run away from a lot of experiences.
Jesse Winchester, who died in April 2014. And that's all the time we have for today. I hope you enjoyed the program. Please send us your memories of Jesse Winchester or any other ideas or suggestions you might have about Rewind. Our email address is rewind@cbc.ca. That's rewind@cbc.ca. And, of course, please go to our website where you can find this program, many of our others, Leonard Cohen, Signs of Spring, The Guess Who, and many, many more. That address is cbc.ca/rewind. Rewind is produced by Marie Kamer, with help from Sharon Farrell. I'm Michael Enright. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.